2 Samuel chapter 10. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. David said, I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun their lord, Do you think, because David has sent comforters to you, that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it? So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each, and cut off their garments into in the middle, at their hips, and sent them away. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, Remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return. When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, the Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beit Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The rest of his men he put in the charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites. He said, If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people, and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what seems good to him. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. Then Hadadezer sent and brought out Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam with Shobach, the commander of the army that Hadadezer had at their head. And when it was told to David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. The Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel. David killed the Syrians, the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen. He wounded Shobach, the commander of their army, so that he died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore.
Thank you, Jeff. That was 2 Samuel chapter 10. First of all, any questions about chapter 10? Any comments, things you observed? Yes, Ellie.
When someone sends you something nice, you ought not start thinking they were up to something.
Well, sometimes they are up to something. Yes, Richard.
I was thinking, the Syrians became subservient. You know, think of the modern time and in the 96, 6, 6, 7 war, when they wiped them all out, all of a sudden they cowered down and
backed
off. And they backed off without they know yield to what they want, you know.
Yep.
And it's and Israel took the Golden Heights, they took the West Bank, and they took the Gaza. No, that's it. Too bad they didn't keep it.
They
up.
Took the Sinai Peninsula too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They had the very same picture. They cowered down. They couldn't fight. You know?
Yep. Yep. Roundly defeated. Any other comments? Well, there's, unfortunately, yes, there is a Kaisik structure here, and if I had a projector, I could show it all out to you, but I knew there wasn't going to be one today, so instead of printing out, which I thought about after I showed up, could have printed it out, we'll get to that in a few minutes, but it's a very simple one. So we'll get to that as we get to the, when we approach that point. First of all, David, it points out in verse 1, 2, and 3, it happened, the king of Ammon died. Who? Which king died? Nahash. Anybody recognize that name?
Is he the guy that took care of David's parents?
No. Well, sort of, possibly. We don't know yet. Nahash, 1 Samuel chapter 11, Saul's first major test as a king. The king of Ammon, known as Nahash, came to and surrounded Jabesh Gilead and told all the people of Jabesh Gilead, "You surrender to me and I will pluck out your right eyes as subservience or kill you. Or that's the only option. Or we go to war and you die." And Jabesh Gilead sent notice to Saul. This is Saul's first test as a king. "Please help us." Nahash had given them, I think it was 7 days to wait. And of course, by the end of 7 days, Saul's army comes over and trounces Nahash's army, the Ammonites. Now, David comes along and says, well, after Nahash dies, as David becomes king, this is roughly about 20 to 30 some odd years after that event with Saul. Well, more closer to 20 than 30. David, the kindness, says, "I shall do an act of kindness for Hanun, Nahash's son, just as his father acted kindness for me." What kindness would Nahash have done for David? That's the question. I mean, think about it. Nahash is the enemy of Israel. Okay, go to war. Nahash is the enemy of Israel, Ammon. They had tried to attack or take out a chunk of a city of one of the tribes, a prominent city at the time, relatively prominent. And Israel, of course, Saul, with God's support and all of Israel's support, came over and crushed him. Didn't kill him, of course, but crushed his army. Nahash then became somewhat subservient to a little bit to Saul and his and rest of the country, rest of that nation. What kindness would David possibly be referring to? Is not Nahash an enemy of Israel?
Maybe he helped him with Saul.
Helped him with Saul?
No. That's illogical. Now, David was running from his...
Was running from Saul.
Oh, and he had allies.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always in the south. I don't remember going over...
Over the Jordan?
Over Jordan. Might have been. I missed it.
Well, the Bible does not give you a reason.
Oh.
So it's strictly speculation.
Okay.
So no one knows. David did have allies on that side of Jordan. At least he thought. Moab.
Okay. Right.
Moab was where allies, which of course are cousins to Ammonites.
Right.
They helped one another. So whatever assistance Nahash gave David, most likely was during the time which David was fleeing from Saul, Nahash's enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
Principle. So whatever assistance he gave, he assisted David while he was fleeing Saul. Now, where was David running around while he was fleeing Saul?
Philistia
for part of it. Where else was he running around? If you recall my maps way back when. south.
Engedi?
You point it. Yeah, Engedi was one of the main areas further south. I've got a mini map, so bear with me. just part of Dead Sea. And we'll do a quick, roughly shape the bottom half of Israel. It's not dead perfect. By all means, don't be angry with me. There was a valley that David ran around.
Well, that's right.
We know where Hebron is, roughly here. En Gedi, as she points out, is right near the border of the Dead Sea. But there was a valley that David would flee to, those out of Saul's reach. That valley stretched through Israel all the way down to where which we would consider the real Mount Sinai. That was part of it. He would, if Saul was in pursuit, he'd flee down there, out of Saul's reach. It was Moab, Amalek territory, for the most part. He would also go back and forth as needed when he went to Hebron or any of those various small towns in around the area. He would flee there as well. Now, of course, Ammon is much further north than this. Much further north than that. That is where Moab lives, not where Ammon lives. So you ask yourselves, what assistance, what kindness could Nahash have ever given David when he never entered Nahash's territory? Well, that's what you go to Jewish tradition. Because David's family is never mentioned again, save one brother. How many brothers did he have?
Seven.
How many sisters did he have?
I don't know.
Two. Well, yeah, we know two by name. The only ones ever mentioned again are the men that are with David, physically fighting with him, which is David's oldest brother, Eliab, as well as his two nephews. Three nephews individually, but one got slaughtered by Abner earlier. That's it. What happened to the rest of his brothers? What happened to his parents?
They were stashed.
They were stashed. Where were they stashed? They were stashed by David in Moab.
And then the guy killed them.
Well, that's the theory, is that Moab, that territory down there, it says David put his family and all of his remaining brothers and their families in Moab's territory. And said, Moab king, take care of them for me, please, while I'm fleeing and dealing with Saul. Was Moab a big friend of Saul? No. So would he likely help David out? Well, you'd think so. David was even biologically attached to Moabites through his great ancestor Ruth. There is some relation there. However, David's family is never mentioned again, save his brother, Eliab, as far as actually doing something beyond the fleeing from Saul. The one that wasn't with the family, Eliab. He stayed with David. His oldest brother stayed with David. The rest of the brothers didn't. They stayed with the families to take care of them. Since they're never mentioned again, no descendants, no other markings, no knowledge, no nothing whatsoever, they've essentially vanished. He gives it to Moab, never sees them again. Theory is just a theory, speculation, there's no evidence, proof whatsoever, so don't even bother trying to search for it, that Moab killed them, or attempted to kill them. We've mentioned this before, a number of times. And the theory, of course, is that any survivors couldn't run to Saul's side, they'd kill them. Can't run south, because Edom would kill them. They can't run further east, because the desert will kill them. They ran north, to Ammon.
Oh, that makes sense.
Since Nahash hated Saul's guts for humiliating him, more than likely, it's possible he may have assisted David's family. That's the only speculation anybody has. But David clearly believes he has some kind of duty to acknowledge Nahash's death and Nahash's kindness. Whatever it was, it had to be profound enough to cause David to have that emotional need. Just speculation. Half clothes, half beard. Verse 4. This is a unique punishment by any measure. So advisors to Hanan advise that David's men were spies, right? That's what they argued.
Right.
Did Hanan believe them? Did he believe the advisors?
Yes.
You sure? Yeah. Are you sure he believed the advisors? Probably, yes, yeah. Tebby.
Well, if he would have believed them, he would have just killed them.
Exactly. He didn't kill them. He didn't disbelieve them, because he did cause a punishment, but he didn't necessarily believe them.
Sounds like the Potiphar solution to me.
Exactly. Let's do a compromise. Potiphar's solution.
Oh, okay.
Don't know if you're right, don't know if you're wrong. We'll just do a partial punishment in case there was something there. Hanun, clearly he did not believe his advisors completely. Why would he not believe his advisors completely? Well, think about who his father was. Hanun knew that Nahash and David were acquainted, that they were not angry or embittered enemies toward one another.
And he knew he helped
David. And he knew he helped David. So Hanun knew his father and David had a relationship strong enough that they meant something to one another. They assisted somehow. So then Hanun obviously had some attachment to that, to acknowledge, okay, they may be here for spies, yes, they have been out to conquer, yet they have never conquered Ammonite territory yet, or any Ammonite cities, but they're conquering everybody else around us, just not us. And then there's a possibility that they're just being friends, we'd be friendly. So he doesn't know if they're conquering or not, so he took a compromise, half the clothes, half the beard. Now, this is a humiliation as opposed to, obviously, a death, clearly. Is it that big of a deal? I mean, the men lose half their clothing. Well, they can go buy more clothes.
Oh.
They lose half their beard. Let's grow another one. Shave the other side, you look clean.
It was a humiliation.
Humiliation.
It was enough that they could have killed them, and they chose not to. They chose to humiliate them instead.
Mm-hmm. What was David's solution to the men, by the way?
Stay in Jericho until your
beards grow back. Why didn't he say, because he could have purchased clothing in Jericho. Why did he say, stay there until your beards grow back? Why did he say, well, just shave the other side and come back to work?
Because they never shaved their beards.
They never shaved their beards. Now, I find this comical because I have always, in my personal history and I guess stereotype, always figured that the modern day Orthodox Jew doesn't shave the sides of his beard because, well, it's a rabbinic tradition. Because they take the Torah's rule and they project it out. That's not actually true. My stereotype image is wrong. They have not been shaving the sides of their beards for a very, very, very long time. Back to David's time period. And most likely earlier. Because a bearded face is honorable. A shaven face is disgraceful. The exact opposite of Egypt's philosophy. A shaven face is is honorable and a bearded face is disgraceful. They offer opposite perspectives. And I'll get to what happened when all of the brothers of Joseph came and they all met Pharaoh. Were they all clean shaven?
No, they all had beards.
No, they all had beards. They're all shepherds. Pharaoh said, go away from me. Go over there. Stay away from the Egyptians. Us clean, holier people. They haven't been shaving their beards probably since well before Abraham. So it is a disgrace to have a shaven beard in Israel at this time. So it can't just say, oh, just shave the other side and come back to work. It'll grow in while you're working. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to have a beard of some form. We don't know the details, don't have a photograph to say. Some beard of some form was acceptable behavior. A shaven face was not. So it was a humiliation. And the Hanun knew it. It goes pretty quick, but we don't know what length it's supposed to be. Who knows? Who knows? It could be, 10 inches long. I don't know.
Well, after it got this long.
Eventually, it starts getting in the way. Eventually, it gets in the way. So far, that's what we know so far. I'm going to go through this a little bit faster. Jericho is an outpost at this point in time. It is not a city. It is a military outpost. Jericho was wiped out, recall that, a few hundred years earlier. And the person who rebuilds it isn't born yet. So it's still an outpost. It's nothing more than a military installation. So these men are amongst what? Other men.
All military.
All military. That's its primary function. Were there probably women there? Most likely, but not very many. Do their job or the commander's personal use, whatever. I don't know the details there. Now, of course, verse 6 obviously points out Ammon realizes, oops. We probably shouldn't have done this. Because unlike the just quick humiliation they thought they'd get away with, and that Israel, that was uncalled for, that they were expecting of a response, they got, okay, now we're going to war.
Bad move.
Not a very wise choice. Is Ammon a fairly bold nation?
It would appear not, so.
It would appear not.
They had to get the allies quickly.
Why?
Stupid.
Why is that? Why did they not have an army big enough to do or address any of David's men? Well, what happened to the father under Saul's rule? Saul obliterated them.
Yeah.
This is within 20 roughly years or so of that age, at that point in time. Well, 20 years. Can you rebuild an entire army in 20 years?
No.
Not likely. Because you have to have people...
Large.
Yeah. They wouldn't be skilled in fighting yet. No, you're still learning. You still have some basic things you got
to
learn.
Skilled in fighting, then going to war, then you learn how to fight.
Exactly. You have to go to war first. And they're a little young to be going to war, roughly, 20 to 30-year-old men who just haven't really had a whole lot of war to go to. So how much does he pay to hire men to come and help him? Now, of course, this chapter here doesn't tell you. It's First Chronicles says how much he pays. 1,000 talents of silver is a price tag to hire these other armies.
Wow.
How much is that? Modern-day money, roughly. I don't realize silver exchange rate's been changing quite a bit lately. But back when I wrote this down a few weeks ago, about 25 million, roughly.
Oh, wow.
Roughly. Yeah, I realize the talent, the exact measure of the talent is questionable. Because is it the Jewish royal talent? Is it the commerce talent? Is it the poor person's talent? No one knows for sure. I speculate it's probably the royal talent, but I really don't know. It's about 150 pounds worth of silver,
wow.
Roughly. So $20 to $25 million to hire this military. Is that a lot of money?
Yeah.
It is, but not an exorbitant amount. I mean, if I have to go out, if I have to go purchase, 20 to 30,000 troops to come battle for me, $25 million, that's not all that much when you think about it. That's why all the money he had, though. Considering he's been subservient to Saul for so many years. And this is another indicator of the strength of Ammon's army. Where were they stationed versus the Syrian army stationed?
At the gate.
At the gate. The safest place you could possibly be. Oh, they're quick, close the gate. Ammon's men were placed near the gate of the main city, the city of Ammon. I forgot the name they call the city at this point in time. They haven't named it Ammon just yet, like the modern-day Ammon, but it's the same city. They had the men stationed really, really close to the city. Where are the Syrians stationed?
In the field.
The mercenaries. Which field? Field of what city?
I don't remember.
The children of Ammon wage war at the opening of the gate. They're in the field by themselves.
I don't think, because he said his troops over the Jordan, so I think they're on the other side of Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Over there by, in the fields of Ammon.
Let's see here. I have written here, hold on a minute. Please. The Urshai save you. Oh, one of these verses has given me a name.
I didn't see that.
Oh, crud. I wrote it down somewhere here. I just read the verse it was written in. Anyway, it's approximately near Medina today, modern-day Medina. Crap. Look at the map again. Anyway, it's near. It's not very far different from Medina. I just can't figure which verse is written in. They don't call it Medina. They call it another name.
Is it verse 16?
It is verse 16.
The Syrians who were beyond the river?
No.
Halam,
right. What is he did against David again. That may have been Medina. I'd look that again. Anyway. It's roughly not too far from Medina, modern-day Medina, which is 15 miles from the city of Ammon.
What?
15 miles away from the city of Ammon. So you have two armies separated by a huge span. Now, the open fields of Medina, you don't know exactly where in the open fields, but most likely toward the Ammon side. It is, whereas Ammon, the city, the city map's too old. You're the conquest of Canaan. They didn't name it Ammon yet. Anyway, we're about 15 miles away. Not exact 15, because we don't know how close they were to the city within that, to Ammon's city within that distance. But anyway, the armies were separated out by some spans, some distance. They're in the field by themselves, as it points out, independent of Ammon. Joab comes along in verse 11. He explains contingency plans to his one remaining brother, Abishai. What's the plan? He sees that he's outnumbered. He's sandwiched in the front and the back. He's got armies on both sides of him, which normally, militarily, if you're surrounded on both sides, what typically happens? You usually lose. Usually you lose. Surrender or die. There's pretty much only two options you get. So normally he would surrender and die, but what's the contingency plan he gives to his brother? First of all, he takes, obviously, men away. He says, all right, I'm going to take these few men. And by the way, they're outnumbered here, in case you're unaware of that. The 20,000 troops of or 40,000, whatever, it's a lot of troops on one side and very few troops on the other side, but they're outnumbered. Not by a lot, but outnumbered a little bit. So he takes the best he has. He says, Abishai, if I'm overpowered, you are my salvation.
So it looks like Joab attacked first.
Yes, it does look like Joab. Looked like he attacked first.
Yeah.
And he said, Abishai, if anyone overpowers you, I am your salvation. Did he give a third plan?
Well, that's sort of what it appears. But there is one more thing he does add.
He could have just stopped it there. What happens if both sides are overpowered? What does he say?
Be strong, let us both be strong. For the sake of our people, the sake of our God, for the sake of the cities of our God. And the Lord will do what is good in his eyes.
We're in a wilderness, we go forth anyway.
Yeah. Because if Joab is overpowered and Abishai is overpowered, what happens?
You
both die. There is no third salvation. But who's the third savior?
God.
God was. The reason why I focus on this particular verse, because although I have wrote here, a chiastic turning point. There is a chiastic structure in this chapter. I don't have a projector to show it to you. This is the verse, is the center of that chapter, of that structure. This verse is. This is a turning point to the verse. Up to this point, all you have is Israel being either humiliated or trampled upon or overpowered or over outnumbered by their opponents. Then after this verse, everything flips for them. They become the dominant one. They overpower. They destroy. They take over. And they kill. This is the moment which the story changes. The events start changing. It's a minor point. I'm not going to nothing profound about it, but it's a note that obviously this was written in a particular fashion to draw our attention to the faith of Joab and Abishai.
Yeah,
the belief that they had.
And God did do.
Because they could have turned around and said, we're outnumbered, let's flee. But they chose not to. Their faith was such that they knew this could kill us both, or either one of us. And they go to battle anyway. That's a strong faith to know, to do. It's to our observant, these men believed and had faith in God. I always think of, you know, when I go through the story of David, have the faith of David, the faith and the strength and power of David. What about David's men? What strength and faith did they have?
The same. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been his men.
Exactly. They wouldn't have followed him.
Because they're fighting in verse 12, be of good courage and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. Their fighting is not
to dominate. It's not the goal to dominate.
Or anything except to fight against the enemies of God.
Right. To me, I look at that and I read that. Wow, that's a profound point and turning point in someone's life. When they know, I'm not going to likely live through this. I'm going to do it anyway. Much like when I discovered when Saul was going to battle, knowing full well he and his sons would not live through it. it's a turning point where you say, okay,
this is it.
This is it. I'm going to do it anyway. I find that interesting. I find that courageous. It's a point to note. Of course, Joab attacks. Ammon flees. The Israelites go and conquer Ammon?
No.
They go to Jerusalem. They go home, don't they?
Yeah.
Did Ammon actually lose the battle?
No, they just ran.
They just ran.
Okay.
They just ran. Ducks back in the city and closed the gates. Which comes the next question. If the whole purpose of the humiliation of Israel, and it spawned this, okay, Davis brings our, let's go attack Ammon. And they went across Ammon and Aram, the Syrians. They say, okay, we'll conquer the Syrians, and I want to say, Ammon, bye.
He humiliated the Ammons already.
He humiliated them back.
No. But he didn't do anything to them, per se.
Humiliated them, though.
Just humiliated
them.
Their money was wasted. Their money was wasted, essentially. Well, their money was wasted.
They closed the gate.
They closed the gate. He doesn't actually, in this chapter, he doesn't actually go after Ammon. He doesn't actually destroy Ammon. He doesn't attack them to avenge, if you can use the term, the servants that were humiliated. But yeah, you could say, okay, it was a humiliation, but it wasn't a physical humiliation. It's more of a, oops, our money got wasted, got burned, let's just flee. We'll flee to find another gate. In a manner of speaking, he did, so far. There's another issue here that shows up. They go back to Jerusalem. It's the next chapter. They say, okay, now let's go take on Ammon. You see, when David's men got humiliated, they were there to pay tribute to or acknowledgement to Nahash's death. Well, when did Nahash die? What time of year? Well, we have no idea. What time of year does any person die? Well, random. Was it in the middle of winter?
Probably not.
Maybe. Nahash, a man dies in the middle of winter, it could happen. Older man, it's potential. Is that a good time to go to war?
Nope.
No. It's a very poor time to go to war. The fields have no grass for your cattle to support your military, because you're going to be running in mud and muck and cold and die of disease. Very bad timing. But is it David's nature to wait for a more convenient moment in time? He's never waited for a more convenient moment in time to do any avenging of God in any fashion. If he's never waited in the past, he's not going to start now. So his intention is to go forth to Ammon to humiliate them. Of course, what happens? He doesn't matter humiliate them. And then he crushes Ammon, and they run. The next chapter, he says, okay, it says when, but I'm not going to read it too much, but it happened at the turn of the year, the time which the kings go forth. That David sent his military. Yoash. Battle time. Battle season. It's spring. Let's go to war now, because now the full force, the army can be there, it can be fully supported, fully fed.
Yeah, exactly.
All summer to kick somebody's rear end out and do some real work.
All camping out season.
Yes.
Be at the gates of Moscow. I mean,
exactly.
Yes.
Gates of Moscow. So it wasn't good timing to go take over and conquer Ammon. After this one battle, did the supplies that were sent with Joab and his brother, were they sufficient to sustain two battles? A battle against Ammon and then go off and siege a city? Not likely. They probably had enough supplies to siege the city like they were intending to do.
One more.
But they, oops, we have Ammon. I can't siege the city right now. Let's spend our effort, our military equipment, bows, arrows, whatever they use, and go crush Ammon. They spent all their energy on that. Spent their money on it, essentially. Aram, Syria. I got the words mixed up. Aram, Syria versus Ammon. I apologize. So crush Syria. So Syria gets crushed. Okay, now we don't have any supplies left. Let's go back home. We'll wait when it's time to go forth, go conquering, and we'll come back then. Which is essentially what happens. It sets the perfect stage for David and Bathsheba, but we'll get to there when we get to that chapter. unlike the Ammonites, Syria says, we were crushed. And they don't go home. The Ammonites run. They flee. But Syria doesn't. Okay, we're not going to take this whippersnapper smacking us around. These are it's a tiny little weak country. We're the great Syrian Empire. We're huge. We're twice, three times, not five times their size. Military-wise alone. So they can conquer this little
riffraff. At this point in time, slowly beginning to get together as a unit.
Right. They're slowly gaining power, but they're not that strong yet.
Because he's still... Has he become king of all of Israel?
Yes, he's all of Israel at this point.
He's just now starting to unite them.
Right, he's starting to unite them. I mean, he points out that his two nephews, Joab and Abishai, are more powerful than him, while he's still a new king. So these nephews of mine are greater than I am. I cannot be against them yet.
Right.
He doesn't go against them. He sticks his son on them. Solomon, please take care of these two. I was not strong enough of a king to do it. We are not quite sure what Solomon does, but it doesn't really matter. So Aram comes and ends together before the ideal time of going to battle even arrives yet. Word sent to David. David says, okay, I'm taking this one myself. Thanks, Joab. Thanks, Abishai, for the quick excursion we intended to do. Now it's got a much bigger scale. I'm coming in as the commander. Of course, David covers over and crushes him completely. Now, this chapter here records he knocked out 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen. 1 Chronicles records it was 7,000 chariots and 40,000 horsemen. Whether it's 100 or 1,000, hard to say, but 700 chariots with 40,000 horsemen, I'm more inclined to think there was more chariots than horsemen. Footmen, whatever you call them. The number of chariots there, based on that size of other soldiers he killed, the horsemen he killed, were probably greater. My inclination, I wouldn't be surprised if there were, in fact, 7,000 as opposed to 700. But it's a minor point. It's not terribly important. But strength, it shows the strength and power and resolve of David and his men. Of course, they get defeated. Shobach, the commander of the Syrian army, dies. Now, if I can show you the Kaisik Shosh, you'd know that Shobach is compared to Joab. Because Joab's called the commander of Israel army. Then at the earlier section of the stage, and Shobach is the commander of the Syrian army. It's comparing Joab to Shobach, as far as their strength, power, and ability. It contrasts the results, too. It shows that the power that was with Joab was all along, and that he survived the process. God was always with him to start. And it ends at Shobach, God was never with him to begin with. He was relying on brute strength alone. There's a number of other comparisons as far as how the Israel army and the Syrian army and the Ammonite army array themselves. They compare the two and contrast the two inside the same structure, but they're minor details, not terribly important, but they are there. The intention, of course, is always draw your attention and your notice to Joab's faith. That's the goal of that structure in this chapter, to draw your attention to his faith. And what that faith accomplished for him. It accomplished in a comparison between Israel, Syria, and Ammon, and saw that Israel neither was defeated nor would flee. That's power behind you. That's God's strength behind you. You are not defeated and you will not flee, which is perfect. Matches Joab and David to a T. They are not defeated and they will not flee.
But you have to have the courage to.
You have the courage to know you might die from it. No different than Daniel and Daniel's friends. Will not cave to bowing. I will not run away. Even though it may kill me.
We know not.
And do it anyway.
God will do, but.
We pray he's on our side. This is a relatively short chapter because chapter 11 becomes very complex with David and Bathsheba. I don't want to go there yet because we're going to tie that one to a number of other earlier events that occur in the Bible. Any comments on chapter 10? Yes, Barbara.
Your bringing up courage brings me back to your eighth day message at the Feast of Tabernacles that you brought up that we had to have courage. You did.
Yeah, so replay so that in my head. All the things I rattled off there. I have my notes on me, so I don't remember all of what I said that day. There were parts of it. All those analysis of the four terms discussed as far as when, as the defined for salvation and such. Yes, okay. Now I recall most, but yes, okay. Thank you. Sorry, it's been a little while. I apologize. My mind's not quite that quick. There were a few items there. You're right. Courage is a very detailed, very functional and primary thing of it.
He had the same kind of courage that David did when he went against Goliath.
It is the same courage. You're right. It's knowing that God's on your side. Whatever happens,
I'm gonna do what I've got to do, but God, this is it.